loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Former President of Brazil, Lula da Silva, was convicted of corruption and sentenced yesterday to nearly 10 years in prison. But his legal team says that no evidence was produced and that the charges were politically motivated. We'll speak with one of his lawyers about the case and the coming appeal. Donald Trump is in Paris for talks with French President Emmanuel Macron ahead of the Bastille Day commemorations. The corporate media is emphasizing the stylistic differences between the two men, but they have one thing in common, at least, what they're going to do in Syria. Senate Republicans have released a new version of their so-called health care bill that will lead to millions of people losing health care insurance. But with a slim Republican majority, the bill's success remains very much in doubt. But first, we turn to Lula and Brazil. We are honored to be joined from Sao Paulo by Valesca Teixeira Martins. She's a lawyer for former President Lula. Welcome, Valesca.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us. This is a great opportunity for our audience, which is listening mainly to corporate-owned mainstream media about the events in Brazil. And we wanted to be able to have you, the lawyer for Lula, to come on and to describe from your point of view what's actually going on. Dilma Rousseff, the former president of Brazil, who was removed in what I and many others consider to be a legislative coup, said after the sentence was announced, quote, "Lula is innocent, and this conviction deeply hurts democracy. Without evidence, Lula, the most popular president in the history of the country and one of the most important global statesmen in the 21st century, has suffered full-fledged persecution for years." Tell us about what's happened in the last 2 days.
Well, President Lula has been convicted in a procedure before the car wash operation with not only not convicted based on any evidence of guilty, we have proven overwhelmingly that he's innocent. We have proven through 73 witnesses actually cleared Lula from any wrongdoing related to Petrobras or anything related to the famous beach apartment. I don't know if you are aware, but this procedure is mainly on regarding the property of a beach apartment that the prosecution claims belongs to Lula. However, 73 witnesses have cleared him, have said that he never had the keys of the apartment, never slept in the apartment, and the property. That, of course, has been proven through document. Overwhelmingly vast amounts of documents. The last document that we have found is the apartment has been mortgaged throughout the period that they say the apartment belonged to Lula. Not only that, but the company fiduciarily assigned the economic value of the apartment to a fund, to a pension fund in Brazil. Therefore, in order for the property of the apartment to be assigned to Lula, there would be necessarily a deposit in a specific bank account of Caixa Econômica Federal, thus allowing the property to be transferred. So when you talk about the apartment belonging de facto to him, first of all, it's not even a legal term in our constitution and our legal system. Second of all, no possession, no property, nothing whatsoever of wrongdoing related to Petrobras. So this sentence convicting Lula to almost 10 years in prison is a political one. Lula is suffering a political persecution. And Sergio Moro, in his sentence, out of 962 paragraphs, spent simply only 5 paragraphs on the defense's documents and evidences, and he says that it's not relevant. So Lula, yes, is being persecuted. He's being a victim of lawfare, which is the misuse of judicial instruments of the law for political persecution.
Just help the audience understand, what is the government saying Lula was guilty of with the property, the beach house, that you are asserting, in which you have ample evidence to prove he is not the owner and doesn't have the keys and it's not his? But what is the government, just briefly, because I want to talk about the bigger political issues, what briefly is the government saying?
The accusation of the prosecutors is that Lula came into power in 2003 and nominated, appointed directors to Petrobras to steal from Petrobras, and that through three contracts with a construction company, Lula obtained an upgrade and in a beach apartment, and which would be a transfer of property de facto.
So the government is saying Petrobras, which is Brazil's national oil company and state-owned, that under Lula, money came back, and Lula somehow used the money to do an upgrade on a beach house that they say he owned, and he says, it's not my house. That's essentially what it is. And then real quick, how does the system work? Was there a jury? Like here in the United States, there would be a jury of 12 people. There'd have to be a unanimous guilty verdict in order to be found guilty. Then a judge has the power to sentence you, of course, to prison. But what's the system in Brazil?
Well, the system is our system is not compatible with international standards of human rights. What happens here, and it's an inquisitorial system, is that the judge in charge of the investigation, therefore in charge of collecting evidence and working closely with the prosecutor's office and with the federal police, is then, by accepting the charges, the sole juror. I mean, he's the judge and the juror himself alone in one person to judge the merits of the case. There is no jury. He is the only one to judge the merits of the case, which intrinsically and undeniably makes him biased. Just this mere lack of legislature correctness makes him biased. We have filed a communication before the United Nations Human Rights Committee in Geneva, asking Judge Moro to be removed from this procedure because he has clearly and grossly violated not only Lula's, but his family's human rights, basic human rights, during the investigation. But amazingly enough, he has been capped in the investigation. And now, surprisingly, with the overwhelming evidence of Lula's innocence, he convicts Lula. So it is a shocking. It is an attack on the rule of law, and it's an attack on Brazilian democracy.
Lula may have been, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, about to run for president in 2018. We had Dilma Rousseff from the Workers' Party. And just for our audience, the Workers' Party won four straight national elections, the last one being in 2014. She had like 52 or 53% of the vote. Then the opponents of the Workers' Party initiated impeachment proceedings against her on the basis of corruption, even though no one asserted that she was individually corrupt. In fact, just the opposite. Then Michel Temer, her vice president from another party, became the president after she was driven from office. He's very unpopular, and he's now been the target of a scandal. And so with approval ratings in the single digits, it was likely if Lula, the most popular president and politician in Brazil's history, was to run again in 2018, he would win the election and the Workers' Party would come back as in charge of the executive branch. With these charges, does that mean that process is over? Is there an appeal? What happens now?
Well, it's not over. This illegitimate sentence of decision by Moro has to be confirmed by the appellate court in Porto Alegre. And we have absolutely certainty that it will be overruled and overturned because, as already said, there's overwhelming evidence of his innocence. We will fight this. We will keep on appealing through all levels of the judiciary in Brazil. And we are absolutely certain that Lula will be able to run in 2018 if he so chooses to do.
We're speaking with Valesca Teixeira Martin. She's the lawyer for Lula da Silva, the leader, the founder of the Workers' Party in Brazil, the former president of Brazil, the most popular political figure in Brazil, someone who was likely to run for president soon in 2018, but he's now been convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison. I mean, Lula is not a young man. Go ahead.
Well, he's not, but he, as he says, he's been working out every morning. He's got pretty good health, and he's really excited with the possibility of running in 2018, if, of course, it comes to that. He's it's very important and noteworthy that the fact that he's in leading all of the polls in every single scenario in Brazil. So, and today, even today, he gave a press conference where he said that if the Brazilian people wants to, he will come back and run for president in 2018. And as he says, he'll come back and do more for the workers, for the removing millions of people out of poverty, sharing the country's wealth with its people. So I think he's pretty young spirited. As one would say.
Brazil was making immense progress, and there were vast social reforms helping poor people in the first part of this century under Lula's leadership, under the leadership of the Workers' Party. And then there was the 2007-2008 financial crisis, really started in Wall Street by the greed of Wall Street bankers, but it rippled throughout the world and especially hard hit on developing countries, emerging markets, and countries that were dependent on extractive commodities, including oil, for instance, where the price of oil, as we know, went from, I don't know, whatever it was, $120 a barrel down to $28 a barrel. So there was a big economic crisis, a big economic crisis impacting many countries, including Brazil. Did that lead to sort of a dissipation of support for the Workers' Party later? And what's the situation now? Because we just saw back in April, after Dilma was pushed out of office through the impeachment, 35 million people in Brazil participated in that huge general strike that seemed to me to be against the government of Temer and in support of the Workers' Party.
Yes, of course, as I've already explained, all of this is pretty much intertwined with what's happening with Lula. After all of this immense effort into getting the Workers' Party out of office has been done, and Lula could not run again in 2018. So we believe, through all of what we have analyzed in the files and with all of the illogical, unconstitutional charges brought against Lula, that it is politically motivated, and it is in order to remove Lula from his political life and from doing politics in the country for what he stands for and for what the Workers' Party stands for.
Okay, so say again, when will the appellate court rule?
There are so many variables, and we are now going to file an appeal before Judge Moore himself. And from there, we're going to have that deadline to file an appeal before the appellate court and before a panel of three judges in Porto Alegre. And but we are still hopeful that several appeals that we have done throughout this procedure will be accepted, and perhaps we might be able to keep on producing more evidence in this file and reopen the case. So it is. There are so many variables to this. It's very hard to predict when a confirmation or acquittal from the appellate court might come at this point. It's very premature.
You're listening to the voice of Valesca Teixeira Martins. She's the lawyer for Lula da Silva, the former president of Brazil, who was convicted and sentenced to nearly 10 years in prison yesterday on the eve of what will be the 2018 Brazilian national election, in which he was intended to run again. You have the judge. You have political opponents within both the upper and lower house in Brazil from other parties, not from the Workers' Party. Those are forces that have been designed, you know, worked in concert to undo the Workers' Party rule. And again, the Workers' Party won four consecutive national elections. Valesca, talk about media coverage. Has there been media bias against the Workers' Party? How big of an impact is the media in Brazil?
Well, absolutely. Parts of the media in Brazil have been absolutely biased and negatively towards Lula. This is what we call the lawfare, and it's the basis of our communication to the Human Rights Committee of the UN, because gossip starts from, this is how the whole procedure started. They came from the media, went on to become investigations, and then the investigators, the prosecutors, leaked information to the media. So this system kept on working for all of these years, retrofeeding each other, and thus creating a violation of Lula's presumption of innocence and allowing procedures, illogical, unconstitutional procedures, to go on. They create a smoke of he must be guilty of something, a smoke cloud that he must be guilty of something, when all of the procedures, all of the charges, they are all illogical and absolutely without any evidence. And I can guarantee you that we're going to fight all of the charges. We're going to keep on explaining to anyone who's interested, anybody who's interested in Lula's innocence and what's happening in Brazil, which is very dangerous, not only to Brazil, but to the world. The region has already suffered too much in terms of how this lawfare works, which is, again, the political misuse of judicial means. We're going to be fighting and prove Lula's innocence in all charges.
And what's it like in the street? I mean, of course, you have a diverse and very, very large country. But what's the mood inside of Brazil? You have Dilma Rousseff impeached. Then you have Temer taking power. Then the story comes out that Temer is supporting people giving hush money to Cunha, the initiator of the impeachment articles in the lower house, who's in prison himself. And now you have this arrest of Lula, the most popular political figure. What's the mood in the street? And again, just going back, do you anticipate, absent a sort of an appellate court sort of absolving Lula, declaring him innocent, do you anticipate a growing polarization inside of Brazil?
Yeah, well, first of all, Lula has not been arrested and will not be arrested. There are no grounds for his arrest. So we do not work with that possibility. We strongly believe that the appellate court will absolutely acquit and absolve Lula of any of the charges related to this decision from yesterday. What becomes more evident from the files and from what we have observed as lawyers is that the difference between Lula and the rest, all of the rest of the charges that have been brought up to the public's attention, is the lack of materiality. There's no evidence against Lula. There we have proven evidence of innocence. And this differentiation is very important because meanwhile, Lula is being persecuted and not prosecuted and is innocent. And in relation to the rest, apparently, and again, I have not read the full files, apparently the accusations have not been frivolous. There has been evidence of a wrongdoing, which is absolutely the opposite of what happens in Lula's charges and Lula's procedures.
That's right. Okay, so we had the very, very, very corrupt going after Workers' Party leaders, Dilma, and now Lula. Again, obviously, I mean, it's so clear that the obvious political nature of it. It's been a great honor to have been joined from Sao Paulo by Valesca Teixeira Martins. She is a lawyer for Lula. Of course, we'll continue to follow this story as it plays out in the coming days and weeks and months. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump is in Paris for talks with French President Emmanuel Macron ahead of the Bastille Day commemorations. The corporate media is emphasizing the stylistic differences between the two men, but they have at least one thing in common, perhaps, that is the partitioning of Syria. We are joined from London by Dr. Christopher Davidson. He is a professor and author of Shadow Wars, The Secret Struggle for the Middle East. Welcome, Christopher.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining. During a joint news conference between Macron and Trump, Macron said, quote, "The departure of Assad is no longer a necessary condition for France. We have changed the French doctrine with regard to Syria. Our fundamental task now is to eradicate terrorist groups, no matter what they are." Is this a big development? Of course, it corresponds to what appears to be some adjustment, at least coming from Trump, maybe not from the Pentagon generals who are really driving U.S. policy, but talk about it.
Well, I think it is a very big development, but it's also a very predictable development. The Western powers collectively, and I think we shouldn't get caught up in relatively small differences between different leaderships in different Western countries. The big picture is, for the past 5 or 6 years, they've been attempting some form of regime change in Syria. Now we're getting to the sort of point where that's clearly no longer possible, and we see a switch to the plan B, as it were, an effective fragmentation or partitioning of Syria, helping us understand why there's been a bit of backtracking recently on whether Assad needs to go or not. Now apparently he doesn't need to go. But what we see are essentially the United States and their allies on the ground, with powers like France providing diplomatic cover, attempting to hold on to bits and pieces of strategically useful Syrian territory.
Let's talk about the difference between Syria and Libya, say, in 2011. Obama, then Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, the Pentagon, they got the UN authorization, UN 1973 resolution, presumably to protect civilians. That was the pretext. But then it was the French and the United States and the British that bombed Libya endlessly and mercilessly until finally the head of state, Muammar Gaddafi, was overthrown and lynched in the streets later. Now we appear to be this, and then they had the sort of the bit in their mouth. They went to Syria. They thought, well, this will be easy. We'll do the same thing in Syria. For a number of reasons, that hasn't come to pass. Are you suggesting then, Christopher, that it's the relationship of forces, in other words, the inability of the Western powers to carry out regime change, more than, say, the difference in political or personal orientation between Macron and Trump that's evolving U.S. policy?
Yes, I think the differences between specific leaders is really a sideshow. The bigger picture here is the Western powers in 2011 had more or less the same objectives in mind for both Libya and Syria. In Libya, it was relatively straightforward. Effectively, the no-fly zone could be extended to actually attacking the Libyan government's troops, while allies of ours, including Qatar, could even insert their own boots on the ground. So we had a sort of uprising being encouraged to spread into a nationwide rebellion. The problem in Syria was that the air support couldn't really be provided due to more complicated geopolitical circumstances, namely the involvement of Iran, and then a little bit later, the involvement in Russia. Essentially, both Iran and Russia coming good on their alliances already in place with the Syrian government. So we had a much more chaotic response from about 2012 onwards to this, where we start to see the various opposition groups on the ground becoming more and more fragmented as the different powers seeking to overthrow Assad all try and get their bits and pieces of Syria for themselves.
I want to ask you, in terms of if we step back and look at Iraq and look at Libya and now look at Syria, you mentioned the fact that Plan B may be going into effect, both for the United States and France. And, of course, France was one of the two primary colonial powers in the region and in Syria in particular. And that is to fragment Syria. In other words, to have zones of influence or control whereby the United States, either directly or through proxies, has some influence in a post-ISIS Syria, post-war Syria. When you look at the big picture and you see Iraq is in fragments, Libya is in fragments, Syria now appears to be in fragments. These were unitary countries that, in spite of the fact that there was ethno and sectarian and religious differences, they had a government that had a unitary nationalist rather than sectarian orientation, and they kept the countries together. Do you believe that this fragmentation was the plan, was the design by Western powers like France, like the United States, or is it more or less the unintended consequence of a military strategy and policy that was just a complete failure?
Well, I believe going back to late 2010, 2011, when this opportunity came along to package these various regime changes under the banner of the Arab Spring, where, of course, we'd seen Western-backed clients in Tunisia and Egypt genuinely fall to what we now can regard as truly nationwide revolutions. There was this golden opportunity to repackage the Arab Spring to help assist localized uprisings in Libya, Syria, etc., give them an outside push and outside help to push them forward to lead to regime change. So I think the plan A was very much to essentially take control of these states, such as Libya and Syria, which had historically had antagonistic governments to Western interests, to actually take control, lock, stock and barrel, of those two countries. But now here we are, of course, 5 or 6 years later, and in Syria's case especially, that's just no longer practical. The alliances that the Syrian government has had have proven much stronger than initially anticipated. So we've got the sort of next best thing, which is to actually hold on to pieces of territory. Of course, we're now aware that the United States has actually built air bases in parts of Syria. We know that various Gulf states and their allies on the ground are really settling in to try and hold on to these pieces of territory, rather sadly, even if that means de facto mini Islamic states or other Sharia law states are now going to exist in parts of a country, Syria, which used to be relatively tolerant and cosmopolitan and was a home to, of course, Christians and many other ethnic and sectarian minorities.
When we also look back a little bit further back, but in still recent history, in the last 25 years, the Soviet Union, which was a multi-ethnic, multinational state, that broke apart. Then there was the forced breakup of Yugoslavia. There was the breakup into three pieces of Iraq. That was with the no-fly zones in the south and the north, the two areas where the oil was most concentrated in Iraq. We've had the breakup into different sections of Libya. Southern Sudan broke away from northern Sudan, meaning Sudan, the largest country in Africa, is no more, or no more as it was. It seems like the approach of balkanization of the entire world, or at least not the entire world, but parts of the world, parts of a targeted world, have been operational. In other words, it's just perhaps easier to deal with former enemies if they're just smaller and weaker.
Well, yes, if that particular state is not playing the game, if it's not opening up its economy to unfettered foreign investment, then either it needs to be removed or it needs to be balkanized, literally, which of course was the case with the Serbian-dominated former Yugoslavia in the 1990s. And we've seen that being reproduced again and again. There are, of course, many other examples happening across the world before our eyes at the moment. We're seeing forces, including jihadist organizations, doing remarkably well and holding on to pieces of territory in countries where there have been governments that, again, have largely been antagonistic to these sorts of interests. We saw the dramatic rise of Boko Haram essentially lead to the election defeat of the Goodluck Jonathan government in early 2015. We're seeing the administration in Philippines coming under great pressure as well due to a remarkable Islamic State-led insurgency there too. Similarly, in the very resource-rich Mali government, which had a functioning democracy until the arrival of Al-Qaeda, Islamic Maghreb a few years ago, we're again seeing this sort of partitioning of countries where they become no-go areas, in many cases, as a result of well-funded and very extensively weaponized Islamic extremist movements.
Let's just step back and away from the Middle East for a moment to talk about European politics and what Macron-Trump meeting might mean. Macron obviously was opposed to the British Brexit. He is an advocate of the EU. Britain is now making its way towards a Brexit, towards a final Brexit. Donald Trump was an advocate of Brexit and seemed to be sort of representing some of the same political sentiments or forces within the United States that were behind, at least on the right-wing side of it, which was the preponderant side of it, of the Brexit machination or referendum, however you want to describe it. But then Macron reached back to Trump? I mean, in other words, it seems like somewhat unexpected from what was happening, say, even a month ago in terms of European politics and the way Trump is perceived in Europe. Go ahead.
Well, I think from Trump's perspective, on a campaign trail, he needed to do everything he could to win the election. And that of course, very much included jumping on various populist bandwagons in his own country, also providing support for Nigel Farage and the Brexit movement in Britain, and, of course, the Marine Le Pen National Front in France, too. But, of course, in power, we've seen a very different kind of Trump administration. We've seen one that has really tried to put America first, trying to bring business to America. And that's very much required shaking hands with governments around the world, which can see business being put in the direction of the United States. In the case of France, clearly we have some small-scale personal antagonism between these two leaders. But ultimately, when it comes to the Middle East, Libya especially, also Syria now it seems too, there's really an awful lot that the United States and France can cooperate on as they try to nudge the direction of movement in some of these countries to a situation where we'll have a Middle East that remains within the orbit, as it were, of Western European states and more distantly the United States.
Emmanuel Macron said in the interview that I was alluding to, he said this about Putin, about Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, Russian Federation. I don't think he, Putin, has an unshakable friendship with Assad. He has two obsessions, fighting terrorism and avoiding a failed state. And so that's why convergent views on Syria appear. What's your take on that comment by Macron regarding Putin and the Russian orientation in Syria?
Well, I think for the last 6 years, the French, British, and U.S. governments have rarely lost an opportunity to try to drive some sort of wedge between the Damascus government and its ally in Moscow. I think from Russia's perspective, what they've been very careful not to do is to get too heavily involved in Syria. Now, of course, we know there are special forces on the ground, and we know that the Russian Air Force seems to have done just enough to make sure that the tide of battle has been turned in favor of the Syrian government, but we haven't seen any large-scale deployments in the way we saw in the Afghan war, for example. And I think a big part of the explanation for that is Russia is still very wary of getting involved in a conflict in which conservative, reactionary, Islamic extremist movements will end up fighting Russian soldiers. Of course, Russia today continues to have a substantial Muslim population, as of course the Soviet Union did in the 1980s, and being very careful not to really sort of create a situation where there's so much tension within Russia's own Muslim communities that this leads to a destabilizing situation. So in other words, they've been very careful not to get caught out in a sort of Afghan war version two, where of course they later learned they were actually fighting an Islamist insurgency backed and financed by Saudi Arabia and, of course, the CIA through Operation Cyclone.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're joined from London by Dr. Christopher Davidson. He is a professor and the author of Shadow Wars, The Secret Struggle for the Middle East. I want to go back to something else that Macron said in the interview that was published today. He says, the United States expresses doubts about multilateralism, the United Nations, the WTO, that's the World Trade Organization, and the climate. The world order of 1945, recomposed after the fall of the Berlin Wall, is now in crisis. In this context, Europe is an absolute necessity. Is this intended for Macron's domestic audience, or does it indicate that Macron is prepared to challenge Trump in terms of politics, because the interview was today, just as they're about to meet?
Yeah, I mean, my reading on this is Macron sees a substantial opportunity now to position himself as the leader of Europe, as it were, with Britain very much on the sidelines, partly through their own doing, with the leadership in Germany facing repeated criticism in the wake of essentially having opened its borders to all manner of refugees and having suffered repeated terrorist attacks as a result of that. We've got a situation where the current French president, I think, sees himself as potentially a sort of president of Europe. Now, that's not to say he's going to be challenging the United States publicly. I mean, apart from the handshakes and the various funny episodes where they've actually met each other face-to-face, the sort of macho one-upmanship. Putting that to one side, I think largely they have a lot in common. And I think a sort of Macron-led Europe is not necessarily a bad thing as far as Donald Trump is concerned, because it will still be a Europe that requires some sort of military protection guarantee from the United States. And from US's perspective, a Europe that doesn't include Britain and a Europe that worries about the shadow of Russia is still going to be a very supplicant and business-friendly ally.
In the same interview, Macron was cited as saying, and this goes to the Paris Climate Treaty, which, of course, Trump pulled out as he did through executive order, and he made the point, I'm the president of Pittsburgh, not Paris, et cetera. Anyway, in the interview, Macron says, I will do everything to convince the cities, the states, American entrepreneurs to follow us. Americans will be part of the Paris Agreement, whether the government wants to or not. Okay, we have about 2 minutes left. I mean, Trump couldn't be that thrilled about that. It would seem to me, given all the mass demonstrations against Trump in France, and also the fact that he didn't go to England, UK, partly because of fear of demonstrations, that Macron, by seemingly standing up to Trump, even at the same time as cooperating with him, would be scoring points at home. Is that your take?
Yeah, this is very much a sort of give and take relationship. I mean, these are both politicians, so they have to score some successes and of course, keep their home bases happy. You know, no Western European politician is going to remain popular if they don't continue pursuing climate change policies. And in Theresa May's case in England, of course, we saw the great unpopularity because she refused to condemn the US's withdrawal from the Paris Accord. So from this perspective, you know, all of the other Western European politicians have to hold on to this element of criticism for the United States and the Trump administration. But as we've seen today, as we've seen yesterday with this meeting between Trump and Macron, they found other ways to move forward very constructively.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We're out of time. We've been joined from London by Dr. Christopher Davidson. He is the author of Shadow Wars, The Secret Struggle for the Middle East. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Senate Republicans have released a new version of their health care bill after the previous one provoked considerable opposition from within the GOP. But will this one go far enough in appeasing dissenting Republicans? We are joined from Nashville by Dr. Carol Paris. She's the president of Physicians for a National Health Plan, and in our studio here in Washington, D.C., by Walter Smolarek. He's a political analyst with Sputnik and the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Welcome, Dr. Paris and Walter.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining. Dr. Paris, let's start with you. Talk about what's in the new version of the GOP health care bill released today. Is it dramatically different from the previous version, or are any of the, you know, just talk about what it is.
Well, I think we expected that they were going to include the amendment that Senator Cruz and Lee have been championing, and in fact, it is in there. And what that will do is allow insurers to offer plans that are really slimmed down coverage, as long as they offer at least one plan that meets the Obamacare 10 essential health benefit standards. And what I've been reading is even the AHIP, the American Health Insurance Plans, has weighed in on this and said that this is really a bad idea because it's going to destabilize the insurance market and it's going to create a two-tiered system where young, healthy people will be able to get these slimmed down plans and by adverse selection then create plans where all of the sick people are lumped together in plans that are going to be just simply premium-wise unaffordable. So I think that's a big one. Then there were some other changes, too, some that were actually an improvement. They added another $43 billion to address the opioid crisis. But, of course, that's not actually how much is needed to address the crisis. It's just how much they threw out there to try to bring people like Senator Portman and Senator Capito, Ohio and West Virginia, who have big opioid problems, hoping that that would be enough money to get them to join the fold. And actually another change that I think is surprising and interesting, and that they have actually eliminated two of the tax cuts that would have benefited the wealthy and reinserted the tax on high-earning health insurance executives. And of course, I think that's because they're realizing that in order to get the moderates on board, they're going to have to beef up some things like opioid funding, and the money's got to come from somewhere. And I think they saw these two entities as the least likely to be able to mount a huge lobbying effort to fight it. So I think those are big ones. And then this new bill would allow people to use their health savings accounts to pay for premiums, and to use their people who got a tax credit, that they can now use it to purchase these catastrophic health plans that are high deductible plans that previously with the ACA, you weren't allowed to use a subsidy to purchase one of these, because the feeling is that they're just not comprehensive.
Yeah, thank you, Carol Paris. Dr. Paris is from the Physicians for a National Health Plan. We're also speaking in studio with Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik, a political news analyst. Walter, I'm reading from the Washington Post. Critics, including insurers, believe that providing the option of skimpier plans would draw, meaning skimpier, you get less, you pay less. It would draw younger, healthier consumers into a separate risk pool. That's what Dr. Paris was talking about. That development would drive up rates for the Americans buying more comprehensive coverage on the individual market, which would in turn destabilize the entire market. It sort of begs the question, why is healthcare like based on market needs? In other words, if the private insurance companies, which actually don't provide healthcare, they're the distributors of healthcare, and you pay them a lot of money for the right to have healthcare distributed. And if they don't make more money by including the healthier, younger people who now might spend less than they did in the Affordable Care Act, in other words, give less to the insurance companies, but they don't have to give them much in return because they're healthy, they're going to drive up the premiums for people who have more comprehensive coverage or people who need more. And that's a lot of people in the United States. I mean, why does it have to be based on a market? Why can't it be like, instead of us looking at human beings who need to go to the doctor as patients or just as people, that we're looking at them under this system or the Affordable Care Act system as consumers?
Yeah, I think it's a disgusting system. I mean, if we want to be nice to the insurance companies, we would call them middlemen. If we don't want to be so nice, I think it would be fair to call them parasites. I mean, they truly provide nothing that people really want. I mean, people don't want health insurance. They want health care. And what insurance companies do is everything in their power to try to provide as little care as possible, because that fattens their bottom lines. And these are some of the biggest corporations in the world. I mean, they make billions and billions and billions of dollars every year off of the suffering of sick people. And so now they have this new plan, which are pushed by some of the most, you know, far right wing members of the U.S. Senate, to create, you know, like Dr. Paris was saying, this two-track system where, you know, sick people, people with pre-existing conditions, older people would be in one much, much more expensive, inevitably would be much, much more expensive pool of insurance buyers. And then I think they're very cynically maybe trying to appeal to younger people or healthier people by saying, okay, well, look, you have the option of buying this plan that doesn't really do that much, but hey, at least you don't have to pay that much money for it. And, you know, I think that's really ridiculous and insulting. And if, you know, they're trying to do like a divide and conquer thing, I don't think it's going to work, because young people, I mean, we saw this with the Bernie Sanders phenomenon. We've seen it at, you know, many of the progressive demonstrations that have happened over the last 2 years or so, or even, you know, going back to Occupy Wall Street in 2011. I mean, young people want single-payer health care. They want health care that's not for profit, health care that's based solely on meeting human needs. And I mean, we've seen so much evidence of that over the last several years. So I think that that's really what's necessary now. We really need to take this debate, this attack on healthcare that's coming from the right wing, to go further. I mean, to go beyond just simply doing damage control and preventing them from taking away some of the progressive parts of Obamacare. There were negative parts of Obamacare, but there are also, you know, many progressive things that should be defended. But really, that itself is not sufficient, both in terms of meeting people's needs to get medical attention, and also it's not sufficient in terms of galvanizing like the kind of movement that we would need to take on these insurance companies, which, like we've been saying, do not provide care. I mean, it's an existential issue, of course, for the insurance companies that there is this for-profit system, and they use their vast resources to become extremely politically entrenched. I mean, they give so many millions of dollars to senators and members of the House of Representatives. I mean, the Congress is really, in many senses, bought and paid for. And so it's really only like a fighting movement of the people that's going to be able to succeed in bringing about healthcare for all, you know, Medicare for all, single payer, whatever you want to call it. And so I think that's the bold vision that we need to put forward.
Dr. Paris, you're an advocate for the Physicians for a National Health Plan. You're the president. You're also an advocate for single payer or Medicare for all people. I'm looking at a Washington Post opinion piece right now about the new Republican plan. The writer says this: the bill would utterly eviscerate Medicaid, which is relied on by tens of millions of poor, elderly, and disabled Americans. It would roll back the Affordable Care Act's expansion of Medicaid and cut hundreds of billions of dollars from the program. It would also transform the program into a block grant for the first time, allowing states to kick enrollees off their coverage and cut back benefits. Let's try to unpack this for the broader audience. Medicare is a program that allows older people, once you're 65, to go to the doctor regardless of income. Medicaid allows very, very poor people who don't have the money to go to a doctor to go to a doctor. And this includes poor, elderly, and disabled Americans. Right now, if you meet a certain standard, if you are, you know, your income is below a certain number, you automatically are entitled to Medicaid. If it's transformed into a block grant, that goes away. Talk about how that works.
Well, actually, Medicaid isn't quite even that liberal. In many states, being a poor adult doesn't allow you to qualify for Medicaid. That's what the expansion allowed for. But in traditional Medicaid, that was ideally designed, or it was intended for children, disabled, pregnant women, and older people, especially the population that needs nursing home care. So I'm glad you brought this up, because really, when you describe what the BCRA is doing, it is really a lot less about repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, and really much more a very broad, as you said, evisceration of Medicaid, which is a plan that has been in place as long as Medicare, 1965. This is not the way to make these kinds of changes in a program that's been around and part of the our way of life since 1965. To turn around and do that by reconciliation with 50 votes from 50 senators, that's just not the way to do this. And I think if they're going after Medicaid, if they're successful, I really fear that the next thing is that they're going to go after Medicare and Social Security.
Yeah, so this is the opening shot to take away all of these social reforms, the economic reforms, the things that were won in the 1930s and again in the 1960s as a consequence in the 1930s of the labor movement, in the 1960s as a consequence of the broad movement for social justice spearheaded by the civil rights movement. I want to talk about this as the tip of the spear in a little bit. Dr. Paris, I also wanted to let you and the audience know that we're going to be joined now by Mark Steyer. He is the director of the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center. We're talking to him from Philadelphia. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you for joining. We've been speaking with Dr. Carol Paris of the Physicians for a National Health Plan, trying to understand, critique the new Republican version, the new iteration of their health care plan. One question is, what's the real goal of this plan? Certainly, Dr. Paris has been talking about the evisceration of Medicaid as the tip of the spear. In other words, part of the Republicans' other plans to eviscerate other entitlement programs, including Social Security and perhaps Medicare. So I want to get your take on that. Is that really what it's doing? How bad is it? And also, Mark, let me just ask you this. Do you think the Republicans can unite enough to actually pass this bill?
Sure. I think she's exactly right. As the bill has changed in the Senate, it's become much less of a repeal of the ACA, although they are repealing good chunks of it, and much more an attack on Medicaid. And, you know, that's not unexpected. The Republicans have been against the social safety net, been trying to cut it back for years. And what they're doing is they're shifting the bill to make it a real attack on the most vulnerable Americans while trying to protect some middle-class people a little bit better. The middle-class people the ACA very much service. So, you know, I think that's the direction they're going. Of course, the main point of the bill is really to give a huge tax cut to the very rich. That's their fundamental objection to the ACA and to Medicaid. They want to reduce federal spending, not to cut the budget deficit, but to give them the ability to cut taxes for the very rich. So your last question, whether they're going to get away with it, I actually think they have a very, very hard row to hoe in the Senate. Rand Paul clearly is not going to vote for this bill. I think there are a number of moderate or less conservative Republicans in the Senate who come from states that very much benefit from the Medicaid expansion. And even delaying the Medicaid expansion as the new version of the bill, the repeal of it, of the Medicaid expansion as the new version of the bill does, still leaves states like Pennsylvania very, very much in the lurch. Our estimate of the last Senate bill was that it would force us to end the Medicaid expansion. It would cost Pennsylvania about $30 billion in federal revenues over 6 years. If that happens 2 years down the road, it's still a big hit to our state. It's still devastating. And I think senators who care about the impact of this kind of repeal of the Medicaid expansion, as well as the attack on traditional Medicaid, understanding those numbers, are going to have a very hard time voting for the bill.
Mark, a real quick question. I'll just stay with you for a moment since you joined us a little bit later in the interview. Right now, premiums are going through the roof in many cases. In other words, the insurance companies are saying, well, because of market instability, not knowing what was actually going to happen, they're either pulling out of certain markets. Some places are being left with no coverage or no insurance companies whatsoever. Other places, and this includes a lot of states, the premiums are going to skyrocket. Again, it's all based on having a market-driven system and giving the power to raise prices in the hands of profit-making health insurance companies whose real goal is to satisfy investors' demands. And investors are investing not because they want people to get better when they go to the doctor, but because they want to make the biggest bang for their buck. What will happen with the Affordable Care Act, even if the Republican plan doesn't succeed right now under these circumstances?
Well, first, I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that the insurance on the exchanges is collapsing or that premiums are going up incredibly fast. What we've seen from the new rates being proposed in Pennsylvania is that they're not going up nearly as fast as people fear they are. And the other thing to keep in mind is that if you have 250% of the federal poverty line or below as your income level, you're protected. as long as we keep both the cost-sharing reductions and the tax credits. So real people are not being faced with much higher costs just because premiums are going up where they are. The other thing to be said is that a lot of this instability is a creation of both the threat to repeal the law and the end of what's called the risk adjustment provisions, which helped keep premiums down in the first couple of years of the ACA. And I think if this repeal doesn't pass, we're going to have to see some kind of bipartisan agreement to reinstate risk adjustment, to extend the subsidies up a little higher on the income scale. And then I think we'll see that the exchanges will stabilize. Look, it's possible to insure practically everyone in a country with a system like the ACA if it's regulated and subsidized right. Netherlands has for-profit insurance companies that are so highly regulated, they basically act like public utilities, and insurance in the Netherlands is pretty much accessible to everyone. That may be not what we ultimately want, but we can get a lot better system than what we have.
Okay, thank you. We have 1 minute left. Dr. Paris, your response to that, 1 minute.
I don't think that the insurance companies function in a highly regulated fashion in this country at all. And so I have to disagree with you, Mark, that we could achieve universality at the same time maintaining our market-based private insurance as the purveyor of insurance. I have real concerns about the cost-sharing reductions. If those go away, premiums are going to go up by double digits. In Alaska, last year they were looking at a 42% premium hike, and what they did was actually create an agreement to pay back insurers for the highest cost patients, and that was a strategy that they used to keep the premiums from being astronomical.
Unfortunately, we've completely run out of time. We're going to have to keep this discussion going. I wish we had more time right now. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you're in the Washington, D.C. metro area, you can hear us at 5 p.m. on 105.5 FM. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.